the magazine review. Share Radio's look through the weekend business press.
That's correct. That time of the day when we take a look at some of the stories dominating the inside pages of the country's leading business magazines. It is a big job that requires the help of some rather big brains. I'm delighted to say the owners of those big brains have joined me in the studio. They're the financial commentator, Jonathan Compton. Jonathan, a very good day to you.
Hello.
And, of course, Jake Sumner of Res Publica. Good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon.
Well, you can't really get away from it, really. It's the B word, and I'm not talking bread. Well, bread if you look at it in terms of money, because money is part of the talking point. And that, of course, is Brexit. Let's start with The Economist. Now, their headline on their main article, the two-year countdown to Brexit has begun. And they've really condensed all the key issues in one. The timing of this, of course, quite opportune, given that we've had Europe's response given to us by Donald Tusk. So what's your take on what The Economist has to say on this? Who'd like to start?
Good article. As you rightly say, it summarises the key points, be it migration, be it paying whatever we owe to the EU and the negotiation problems with Scotland, with Northern Ireland, the rest. That's all straightforward. If there's one thing I'd like more on, is there's a sort of assumption running through this that it's static. We know that Europe in the next 15, 18 months is going to go through some very significant changes. We've got various problems financially developing with, say, Greece or, let's say, with Italy, which don't have to be resolved. Actually, have got the slight crisis about them. We also know that some of the key sticking points today, like migration, might well go away insofar as most European countries are hardening their lines, hardening their borders. It might well be that some of the big issues, we find ourselves in the same sort of legislative boat as the EU within 18 months. Clearly, you can make the point the chance of the negotiations being completed in 2 years is zero.
They pretty much intonate anyway in this piece.
The terrifying thing is it might go on for a long time. So far as you take a very simple issue, say Greece's bankruptcy, which popped above the parapet in 2008, we're nearly a decade later, and the resolution is even further away than it was in 2008. And that is a concern to me insofar as business will get round it, people get round it, things can happen. But it does imply that this continuous uncertainty may well have a big impact on capital investment and confidence. Mm-hmm. And that matters.
OK, so it's what the article didn't mention, Jake. Is that your takeaway from this as well?
Yeah, I think that was a very helpful analysis that Jonathan, that you gave just there. I think what all articles and all discussions around this are going to have a challenge is that the Brexit issues are so all-encompassing that you can go down particular furrows, whether, you know, implications for trade, implications for legislation, implications for different parts of the country, and you can go through very different pathways. And part of what we've got to be thinking about is, you know, both the broader picture and those individual implications. And there's going to, as you said, the there's going to be a greater fluidity, and there's probably going to be fluidity in the UK political perspective as well, and how both the political parties are responding and how different parts of the UK are responding. And views and opinions are going to be fluid over the period of time when we really see what the true implications are. Because I think we've had really a few months around the sort of process, when's it going to happen?
Mm. And now, and the shadow boxing.
Exactly. And I think that's a good way of putting it. But now the real meat is there and about the long-term implications. And really, we've got, it just in terms of the Brexit processes, almost like three processes. How to do the divorce and all the implications of that. What our arrangements will be, which aren't really want to be talked about, the transition arrangements. Mm. And then what the future proposition will be. And all of those are tied up. There's different views in Europe on that. They're trying to create a united front. But all of those will have different perspectives. Mm. And whether we can do trade deals in the timescales that that are predicted. All of those things are tied up. And those three processes are quite clear.
But I'm glad as well that you used the word fluidity, because, yes, we will see that working its way through the UK political spectrum, but also in Europe as well. Because, Jonathan, you talked about Greece and the financial system there. You didn't mention Italy. Now, the banking system in Italy, very, very difficult at the moment, and the fear is that that could be the next ticking time bomb. So the point that I'm getting at is that even though Europe is playing hardball at the moment, if these crises blow up at the same time, whilst any negotiation is going on, that could well play to Britain's advantage, potentially.
It could do, and I mean, I hope it works out that way. I think there's a nasty precedent for enough, not so much for Greece, and Italy will blow up. I think it's actually in the prices for enough in the markets. People know that. And eventually, there will be some bankruptcies in the banking system because it's quite clear that Germany is not prepared to do a carte blanche bailout. And that, I think, actually makes sense because the Italian banks have been on their knees, frankly, since about 1910. That's a historical issue.
That was before EU.
I think the real worry is it's quite likely we never have an agreement. And I tell you for why. You take the Canadian trade deals, which were much more recent than the Greece crisis, as it were. And there it was, with eventually all 28 countries being dragged along to a deal with Canada. Pretty straightforward trade deal, actually. It wasn't very complex. It took 11 years. And 1 minute of midnight, it's blocked by Wallonia, which most people can't put on a map. And many EU countries have got that structure whereby a very small province, it might be Sicily, it might be one of the Greek islands, has the power to block the entire EU mechanism. Mm-hmm. We've seen that with Malta, where really the Prime Minister's behaving like he's Napoleon. And you can see the position where every EU country is naturally, politically, going to play for its advantage. And you just might find ourselves drifting into this kind of semi-arranged deal. I think that's the most likely outcome.
Mm-hmm. And I think going back to the point about people's perceptions of this, I mean, you've clearly seen a bit of that with, you know, what is a very complicated process. People saying, well, can't it be done now? Let's just go and make the best of it. But not recognising the huge complexity of just the legislative processes and all the rest of it. I think, Anthony Hilton wrote, I thought, a very perceptive article a few weeks ago on what the implications of the WTO's rule were. Mm. And they're not as people often, and it's often commented, oh, we'll just go back on those. The changes that's been on the WTO processes over a period of time and Britain's relationship with them means the implications are quite profound.
So it's not just the tariffs, this 40% gets thrown onto the goods. It's more than that.
Yeah, and it's the nature of how you deal with the WTO process as a country when you've exited a process that's dealt with it.
So it's another set of rules and regulations to comply with.
But it's the way the process now works on WTO rules, because Britain has been in a club, it's leaving a club, seeking to have previous rules, and then use that process to then have an arrangement with the club it's just left.
Yes.
And the detail beyond that, below that is the complicated bit and the big implications. But that just shows the type of issues there. And I think the final point I was going to make on this, though, is that obviously we've just had a real glide through the Brexit, but it's the issues that the UK in particular, say, faces on how to drive growth across all parts of the United Kingdom, you know, the role of place and devolution, the changes, the political changes it needs to make, the long-standing issues like skills, all of those issues and challenges that we need to address, and climate change, where are they in this process? And you can either view, and sometimes it's been viewed through a total Brexit prism. And actually, that's in some ways a danger. And we really need to make sure there's equal focus, yet there's limited amounts of time, political, you know, economic, social time, and legislative time for the government to focus on all those things.
Mm.
As well as Brexit,
but you could argue as well that is, yes, you can shift the political dynamic to get that focus that you were talking about, but at the same time, administratively, it has to move in tandem as well. And one of the points which the article does touch on is the civil service. They've said that the civil service hasn't actually increased, I think, since the Second World War, and so you've got this small civil service that has to take on this almighty responsibility of negotiating our way out of a 44-year relationship. If we don't hit that deadline, to pick up on your point, Jake, they've then got to move it into the WTO arena.
Yeah, I've worked in government, I've worked in local government, or regional government, and institutions that link to it. And look, it is a challenge. I mean, you know, you can, you know, throw papers together quickly, or they can be put together, you know, advice can be given. But, you know, you want the best people, you want a strong civil service, you want to work through and with businesses and institutions and sectors and et cetera. And really, that's going to take a lot more person power to get that right. And just to replicate some of those bodies, and we're not clear on what some of those will be, how those forms will be, but that's going to take a big thing just to build the new institutions that will be purely replicating the existing EU institutions, let alone anything new.
It's going to be quite curious because taking the agreement I think we have that 2 years isn't going to happen, which is, I think, a pretty easy bet, actually one of the subparts is the civil service is going to have subcontract a huge amount of negotiation to the KPMGs, to the Slaughters and May, because they just do
it's
not
a,
have...
It's a bonanza for them.
It's a field day.
All the think tanks thinking, you know, good thoughts like we're trying to do and see ways through these things, of
anyone
course.
In the private sector who speaks a European language has some legal or accounting knowledge. I mean, it's their birthdays every day. It's just fantastic.
For the next how many years?
Decades.
As you said, it's not a new... I don't think you said it, but it's not quite an event. It's a process that will be for our entire lifetimes.
Yeah. I mean, one final point on this was the politics, which I touched on, because the article has said that one of what this has done is that it's thrown up the weakness of the opposition, because you had a process which was partly driven by UKIP. They've claimed the victory, but they themselves are fragmented. They've lost their last MP. You've got a Labour Party which doesn't appear to know where it's going. In fact, UKIP is tied in with the leadership issue. For Mrs. May, it should be an advantage, but the problem is that she's got some very, very enthusiastic Brexiteers, and they're also going to hold her to account as well. So she's really being assaulted at various angles.
It's quite interesting on that score. I think we don't know her, OK? We've only had her for a few months. We have no real idea how she works. You get the scuttlebutt. We don't really know. But there's two things I think that are emerging. Is firstly, she keeps her council very quiet, which actually is quite sensible. And secondly, she's beginning to have the slight whiff, as it were, the positive way, of Angela Merkel, who has always kept her council. Now, there's a key issue there, is Angela Merkel repeatedly in the last decade has shown an ability to do a complete U-turn on a sixpence if the votes go. And I think we've got very interesting turns coming here in the near future.
Yeah, I agree. And it's a test for our parliamentary system. I mean, part of the claims made during the referendum was, you know, a return to laws being made in the UK. Well, in which case, that's a real test for parliamentarians, our processes, and some of those, let's be honest, have not been updated and have not been fit for purpose for some time. And that is where a breaking point will also likely to take place. And that is at the same time as, and this is too big a issue to be brought in, but, you know, the role of the devolved nations and the positions there, and obviously we've seen what the Scottish Government has proposed and all the rest of it. Mm. One point on that, I suppose, is, you know, the Scottish Government wants to go down an independence route. The thought of the UK being able to negotiate and in all of those things we've just described, as well as a country separation.
Yeah.
And that just then multiplies almost like a chessboard the amount of variables exponentially of, well, what's that asset and what's not.
Okay, let's hold on to those thoughts because we are going to return to Brexit. You can't get away from it. Get used to it. You're going to be stuck with it for at least another 10 years. You're listening to Share Radio. It is, of course, the Magazine Review.
The Magazine Review. Share Radio's look through the weekend business press.
Where my guests in the studio are the financial commentator Jonathan Compton and Jake Sumner of ResPublica. We've been talking about Brexit, really the big talking point of the week. It will carry on for some time. Let's stick with this theme, but looking at it from the perspectives of Investors Chronicle, they were also doing the Brexit countdown, repeating pretty much what we gleaned from that article in The Economist, except that they were talking about the fact that some industries are going to be hit harder by Brexit than perhaps others, and the pressures that's going to place on investors when they're trying to compile the ideal portfolio.
Well, and I think, I mean, the article, really encapsulated in one line where it says trade won't grind to a halt, solutions will be found, and some of these new opportunities for certain companies, and that's largely true. There will be a lot of challenges, and a lot of planning for all those different eventualities. Businesses like certainty, there's a lot of uncertainty ahead. I think I heard Nigel Farage speak, I don't know, about 3 or 4 years ago, and he said, "Oh, I used to be a trader, and I wanted to see the breakup of EU because I can make money on all the different rules and regulations." Now, I suppose if that had been the clarion call during the referendum campaign, it might have received less success.
It might have tipped things the other way.
But exactly. And, you know, and obviously the European Union was designed to try and make processes simpler for businesses. Businesses can make money on complicated processes, but overall, that was the idea. The challenge now is, you know, we've described those complications and businesses will be facing those and seeing opportunities. We're trying to work with some of those to see what are those opportunities and what are those challenges.
Mm.
Yeah, well, I think so, right. I mean, I think the only other takeaway here, as the article points out, is that for a medium-sized business making widgets or doing services, be it on London or elsewhere, is they're going to have quite a significant extra cost just trying to get their heads around the rules, which in themselves will not be clear. You see a lot of legislation with this one coming through time and again. And that is a problem. I'm finding difficulties with these discussions to find the positives. I'm trying to do the best I can, but this is not really a positive. Solutions will be found, for sure, but it's going to be a cost there.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But on the other hand, if you really get that depressed about it, you could always diversify your nationality. Now, this is the ultimate hedge, isn't it? This is an article by Money Week, and they're basically looking at the prospect, well, the idea of getting a second passport, which may sound a little bit drastic, but not if one looks at it in terms of the emotion that this referendum generated and the fact that some people said, well, because of the way that it went, they stopped feeling European. And the article starts by looking at some really amazing statistics about the number of telephone calls and online inquiries that were made to the Irish embassy.
Absolutely. I declare my hand, I write for Money Week, therefore it's an excellent article. It should be bought by everybody, right?
But you didn't actually write that article,
though. Not this article. This has been by Marin, who's the senior editor. I think it was an interesting article. I've been amazed how many people I know quite well have been looking at their Irish passports and getting them, which surprised me. It seems a somewhat dramatic reaction. I think there are two things missing. The first one is a case study I had with two people in my office years ago, is people forget that if you've got dual nationality, you have dual obligations. Mm. And so there's a couple of friends I've got who are half English, half French, who, to their horror in Brighton, found the gendarme outside the back door saying it's time for national service, which law we enforce, by the way. And it's all very fine saying get a Paraguay passport. But actually, I think Paraguay might have a military problem in the next 50 years, in which case it's bing bong and you're off. You're from the Paraguay.
Try and find somewhere else to go, yeah.
And whilst it seems a low-level risk like today, these things always seem low-level till the balloon goes up. The other thing, of course, is double taxation. Insofar as at the moment you've got these taxation benefits, theoretically, OK, we know the UK is grinding towards taxing people on their overseas assets. It's been moving that way for a long, long time, as are most countries. They're fed up with the lack of revenue. I don't call it tax dodging. I think it's good sense. You might find yourself walking into a technical trap where there you are with, let's say, your Cyprus passport. There's a bankrupt country, OK?
Because that was the other one on their list.
Absolutely, and a UK passport. And both of them actually start saying, we really want to tax your assets wherever they are in both cases.
So you end up paying more?
Yes, so you're going to be taxed first. You can negotiate after, OK? But meanwhile, you're out of pocket. So I think those are the two things to add to this idea.
But they also pointed out as well that with some of these passports, it's not just filling out an application form. You've got to lay down some serious cash here.
Yeah, and I think in some ways the article is a slightly frivolous take of a sort of, you know, what some people could do, particularly if they're very wealthy and where they might locate. I mean, obviously, people have been claiming residence or have been living in Monaco for some time to take advantages of that taxation regime, and you know, people driving around very fast cars in Formula One in particular. But, you know, and so very few people are going to probably be able to take advantage of all of these countries. The Irish one is obviously at the close links with Ireland and the UK is there. And so people's heritage are more likely to be there. I think it raises two points, though, in that, you know, we were on a trajectory as a country where, you know, we had relationships with deepening relationships with countries in the European Union where people could go, for example, in Erasmus programs, they could travel widely, freedom of travel and movement. Put away one side, people coming for jobs, and that's the issue that's come, or benefits, perhaps has been cited, although much less on that. And that was a really good, ambitious idea about strengthening cultures, seeing people's cultures, sharing them. And really, we are now moving away from that. And then retrenching and saying, well, I'm, you know, this is my passport now for my country. Before, a UK passport, you know, had that opportunity to be involved in the European Union.
Yeah, it was really, well, I said was. I mean, we are still members of the European Union until the Gordian
knot is slipped. And we don't know we might have the same arrangements.
Exactly, but there was a cachet. There is a cachet with having that British passport and being part of the European Union.
But also, it goes to the point about identity. I mean, this is about how you could probably get a passport if you had some heritage at some point. I mean, part of the whole Brexit debate, going back to that, was particularly around identity and what the UK was. Mm. And I'm not quite sure how that squares with these passport arrangements here.
But it is great if you've got all these people knocking on your door because they suddenly want to have citizenship in your country. Because, I mean, the figures which the article quotes, $250,000 here, or you have to buy a property from the government. I think that's a case of Grenada or something. I mean, you'd probably just think, well, hang on a minute, if so many people are desperate to have double the citizenship, then we might as well just up the price here. Because, you know, we're talking about the accountancy firms having a field day. So can governments, if you think about it.
Yes, I would warn, though, that although the rules as laid out here are the rules,
sure,
they're very negotiable.
It's the flip side. But on the other hand, if you've got the money and paying $250,000 for a passport big deal.
Up to a slight change of the rules last year, £1 million bought your UK passport. You had to invest in the UK under various rules. Actually, all you had to do was buy £1 million worth of gilts and hold them for, I think, 2 or 3 years. This has been going on for a long time. It's just come to a highlight. Clearly, some people will change their passports. I think we'll find that the success rate, that for every 100 applicants, actually about 3 change at the end of the day.
Yeah. And one of the things as well is the growing wealth gap around the world is where do wealthy individuals live? And actually, you know, we've seen some of the implications of that in London in particular, where property prices have rocketed, where it's considered a safe asset.
The resentment it builds up.
And, you know, and the billionaires that are, for example, coming out of China, and you'll probably have the figures better than me, but I know there's tens of thousands, I think, of extremely rich billionaires, and so, you know, that has a huge dollar billionaires, and that has a huge implication on the purchasing of these what are global assets, and again it may be that only a few people end up in Malta or wherever it might be, but there are questions about people being able to buy out. Affected where people live. I'm a Londoner and I'm affected by that.
And wasn't that part of the reason why we had this Brexit vote as well? This sense that people felt that, look, it's not our country and, OK, we've got Brussels, and because of what Brussels is doing, they're making it easier for outsiders to come in to push up the housing, all that sort of stuff.
What you're seeing partially from this article is that capital has become extremely mobile globally, even for the modestly well-off. Well, you can go buy a share in Japan tomorrow, if you like, or you can buy a house in South Africa for, you know, a few thousand bucks. Is that governments have been grappling with how you get rid of mobility. My concern is quite simple, is that one by one, governments are looking at capital controls. Mm. And that is actually kiss of death to the sort of lifestyle we've enjoyed in the last 30 years.
OK, then. In the time that we have available, let's move on to, well, stay with Money Week magazine, in fact, because the other article which caught our eye, how central banks created the bubble in passive investing. So passive investing, these are funds which charge very low fees and they make money for the investors by tracking the underlying market. And what they're really saying here is that they've done very, very well compared to managed funds. But because of that, there's a sense that maybe a bubble is rising.
I think definitely. And for of the articles we're covering today, for anyone who's investing in markets, this is the one to read. The other ones are interesting, op-eds and the rest. And I've been here before, and we've seen it in various crashes. Passive investing is great, as the article points out. It's cheaper, it's more efficient, etc., etc. And passive funds tend to beat most fund management groups active, except for investment trusts. Important that. Look at investment trusts, OK? They're better value. The key thing is, when you've got, let's say, somewhere over 25% of all assets being in passive investing, when conditions change, as they will, and when people have the exit, you will see them close. You are going to see a real problem as these funds close. And in the taper tantrum about 18 months ago, a lot of these passive funds actually went to substantial discounts to their theoretical value. And when these meltdowns come, I can see a lot of these funds closing, which is not all of them can. The ones that stay open will be hammered, because people want the liquidity. This is actually an accident of the making. And it's just a matter of time. It might be tomorrow morning. I doubt that. In the next 5 years, it's a shoo-in.
Because they said the exchange-traded funds could be the needle that burst the bubble.
Absolutely. I mean, if you've got everyone basically following a passive policy and they're all in the same thing at the same time, and someone panics and it does spread like wildfire, you're going to have that closure and discounts and more panic. It's a very interesting sideshow, is that people who are active investors and are stock-picking, say, below $5 billion, there's no analyst coverage. There's a real opportunity now, for the first time in 30 years, to have an information edge, which I think is fascinating. Mm. And we'll see the cycle change back into active.
OK, then. Final word before the break.
I think you're probably much more expert in these matters than me. A takeaway from this is really the record low interest rates, and so the hammering on savers, and then so people trying to, where traditional saving opportunities aren't there, and how people then use their money to get a return. And right. That is the challenge.
OK, then. Gentlemen, we'll break off from that for the moment. You're listening to the Share Radio Magazine Review. My guests in the studio, Jonathan Compton and Jake Sumner.
The Magazine Review. Share Radio's Look Through the Weekend Business Press.
Indeed, you're listening to Share Radio's Magazine Review with me, Juliet Foster, standing in for Simon Rose. I'm joined in the studio by the financial commentator Jonathan Compton and Jake Sumner of ResPublica. So we started our conversation by looking at The Economist. We're going to return to The Economist, a total change of track this time, not Brexit, but Cuba. Their article, What the Tourist Industry Reveals About Cuba. And there's a sense of regret about this because there was so much potential that you had President Obama lifting the embargo, all sorts of marvellous things forecast for the country. You had Fidel Castro dying last year, and it really hasn't quite delivered.
Yeah, I was quite struck by the article. I mean, I went to Cuba in 1994, and I've seen exactly this economic problem and the oddity of the exchange rate. I mean, just by way of example, you know, I exchanged the pesos, and then, which are roughly 300 to the dollar in Havana, went to Santiago, went to a state-run restaurant and took some people out for dinner, and it was 90 pesos for a three-course meal, so in effect a couple of cents. And the economics just didn't really work, and I thought, that is a problem. And we still sit here today. But I suppose we there's many attractions about Cuba in the way it looks and feels and all the pictures and photographs. Yeah. The real question, though, I think which is missing in the article is, it sort of touched on it, but what's next and what's the solution? Because, you know, what is the model that somewhere like Cuba, that's had a very different economic system for some time, should follow to move forward when Raul passes away and perhaps a new leadership or change happens? Because what, should it follow the American model, which has huge challenges that, you know, Trump has come to power? Should it be following what happened, to Russia when it stopped the Soviet Union? I wouldn't think that. Poland had the same size economy as Ukraine when they both left the Russian orbit. Poland joined the EU, had four times the economy. But also there's challenges there now. What is the model, and should it follow Britain? And I think that's where we really need to think about what our economic model should be in the future, so that somewhere like Cuba doesn't fall down the traps that some of the other countries I mentioned we've seen, but actually builds a progressive growth and has a contribution to the economic life of its people and the world. And there's a few other countries like that we can see dotted around the world that might face similar problems.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, whatever the model it takes, whatever the model it is that's embraced, it's going to take a long time to embed, because we're talking about a country which, for the past 50 or so years, this is how it has lived. You can't deconstruct that overnight.
Yeah, and as I said, there's huge implications for jobs. But, I mean, it's not just going to be let's sell everything off, let's do everything. It's going to produce those solutions which 20 years ago, 30 years ago, that's the way it should be.
I think you might be a bit too theoretical here. I mean, at the end of the day, we've got the classics, a socialist dogma-ridden country. It's got those strange foreign exchange certificates like China had,
yeah.
Like Russia had.
It's got something like three exchange rates running or something
absurd,
daft.
Okay? It's very hostile. It doesn't actually like success. Clearly, nothing's going to happen much till either Raul Castro dies or hopefully waddles off and retires in 2 years' time. We don't know about his heir. He might be good, he might be bad. And we've seen this happen in places as diverse as North Vietnam, which sat in stasis for a long time. China is still not very tourist-friendly, frankly, outside the big cities, and so it goes. It's just this extraordinary ability of politicians to have dogma ahead of common sense. I mean, clearly, you have one exchange certificate, exchange rate, you let the currency drop, you decide what sort of tourism you want, upmarket, downmarket, sex, drugs, rock and roll, or music again. There's lots of things you can do. But sitting there doing nothing is just pathetic.
It seems like almost like a nostalgia-based tourism industry, because I went there in the 1990s as well, so I know exactly what you mean about the crazy exchange rate system. And yeah, you've got all the cliches of what Cuba is all about, but at the same time, running hand in hand with that are people who are very frustrated, or certainly that's what we came across, people who were very frustrated. There were things that they wanted to do, but they just couldn't. And there was this very convoluted way of getting simple things done, really.
Yeah. And I mean, it was a highly literate society and still is, had very high levels of healthcare, as we know. The healthcare system
is one of the most successful healthcare systems in the world.
And exports to all sorts of different countries and played different roles in world events. That doesn't excuse the economic issues. But I'm not saying that it needs to be protected or somehow that, the issue is that what is the solution? Because I'm saying if investment came in, people were still separated from access to wealth. They may be ostensibly trappings of wealth, the Starbucks opening bigger hotels and all the rest of it.
But it's a distribution of that wealth as well.
And who has the assets there and how is that controlled back? The state isn't enabling wealth to trickle down, to be shared with people. The model that comes next has to do that, but it's not going to follow the models that I would think have been prescribed before.
Thanks, right. I mean, there's lots of precedents. Thailand, for example, still has some pretty onerous bars on foreign ownership. And so most tourism there is done on a joint venture basis. And the Thais are very anti, foreigners owning land. It works for them okay. And actually, the tourism industry has been booming. There's some very simple steps they can do to not only create wealth and jobs, but actually get tourists coming. Because here you are, the biggest island in the Caribbean, great jungles, great beaches, everything to play for okay. And they're just sitting there, absolutely frozen in some kind of dogmatic black hole. It's extraordinary.
It is a bit weird, but it's an interesting country to visit nonetheless. Let's move on now to somewhere a little bit closer to home, a brand familiar to all of us, Tesco. Now, this is an article in Investors Chronicle. It's slugline, Tesco will compensate eligible shareholders. Now, this really stems back to an accounting error, which slightly underplays it because it was on a very, very big eye-watering scale and Tesco paying the price for that.
I think it's really encouraging because you take, and being slightly offensive on purpose, people like the Serious Fraud Office and the FCA and various other bodies, even 10 years ago, in the face of this kind of fraud, were completely supine. And they are still miles behind the SEC and the states in tracking down people and beating their heads in, which is good. But the fact they've taken on a giant like Tesco, they've pulled apart. Is the fine big enough? Frankly, the fines don't matter. They're mostly tax deductible.
It's £129 million that they had to pay out to avoid being prosecuted by the SFO. But some people will say, well, they bought their way out of this.
You always, at the end of the day, you can go for the righteous judgment, but at the end of the day, you're going to have to get these firms to settle and take some money off them, OK? There's no point in driving to the wall forever and ever. You should be bringing stronger bars on directors being barred, because, I mean, if the directors didn't know, they should be barred. If they did know, they should be barred. That's the next stage to come.
Yeah, because that is in the works, some form of criminal prosecution, though obviously we have to be careful. We don't know what.
But I think we'd be very optimistic that very few people are actually fingered, because that's where the FCA works. But at least the traveller direction has accelerated in taking on a big FTSE company and actually find them culpable, because this would not have happened 20 years ago.
I was going to say, look, I agree with much of what you said, and having a stronger arm on bad practice and malfeasance is absolutely necessary, and we've seen that in a number of different companies and sectors. I mean, it's not right across the piece, but we've seen well-documented examples. It speaks really, though, to the need to sort of change the systems that we've had. And now this isn't a wholesale thing and throwing everything out the bathwater and all the rest of it. But it is saying, well, actually, there should be a greater sense of purpose. This shouldn't be happening. Mm. This shouldn't be happening. And what are the steps that can be taken within companies to have a much better transparency and better processes? Now, that's going to be good for investors. That's going to be better for staff. That's going to be better for their customers. Now, this is not a good situation, right? And that's where, you definitely do need the heavy stick, but they shouldn't be necessary in the first place. There should be much greater probity. And that is where, say, the government's recent corporate governance standards and all the conversation on that, where it's industrial strategy, where work that we're undertaking in Republica is thinking about very much about how to make more purposeful companies that mean these things don't happen and social benefits and better practices are embedded right in the health of the company.
Because this was a big sum involved here in this miscounting error, because it was something like £326 million, which does beg the question, how can you make an error on that scale?
Oh, I can understand that. But it's the duration of the error, which I think is more interesting, because it implies a concerted cover-up by a huge number of people over a long period of time. Interestingly enough, some good analysts did start saying there's something really rotten about these accounts. It was hard to pin down, because I think actually the accounting standards we have are not bad. Mm. We've never produced the perfect example. But, of course, the problem is there's actually no money in blowing the whistle. And the strange way you get around that, where apart from culpability of employees, and particularly directors, fun enough, the whistleblowing acts we've got don't really work. It is still not paying out much. Whereas in America, you whistleblow, boy, do you make money.
Oh, you certainly can. You can make a career out of it. You can become a celebrity because you were the one who blew the whistle on whoever. But Tesco's also been told to set up an £85 million compensation scheme, which people can apply for. But again, the sting in the tail, you've got to prove you suffered genuine economic loss as a result of Tesco's actions. And I guess that the question is, how can you prove that? Or you may feel that you've proven the case, but the actual bar to claiming successfully... Yeah. will be quite high on that, so some people could find themselves out of pocket.
Yeah,
I'm sure they will. I mean, if you're a big institution or an individual, proving that loss is going to be difficult. The time zone is very short. The cost of bringing that case, even a joint action, is going to be very large. I think you'll find they pay out virtually peanuts, or they turn around and say, actually, OK, fine, we think there were 2,000 who suffered during that very short window. Here's 25p each. And the punters will go, that's fine.
I mean, and that's interesting, though, because these sums are huge that we're talking about here. But this is also about, in effect, consumer redress and loss. And, you know, if you lost a pound, but it's very, you know, and it happened a lot, but it's very hard to get that pound back, that mounts up. And that happens at drips and drabs and all different little charges. Now, this happens with a bigger sum, but it speaks again to the point about what's the consumer redress in this, because that system doesn't seem adequate enough. And again, we're in a situation where this company has failed, and yet, consumers, in this case shareholders, are going to suffer potentially because we don't have adequate arrangements.
We've got about a minute and a half left, but another reason why Tesco is making the news, not just because of this, obviously, but it is its attempt to buy Booker, the food wholesale group. Now, this has really pitched them against two of the big shareholders in Tesco, Schroders and Artisan Partners. They own 9% of Tesco between them. They are not happy about this. Now, do you think that those concerns are justified? Their argument is, look, you need to focus on getting your house in order first before you start going out on a major shopping spree, and we don't actually approve of what it is that you're buying.
I've read their criticisms and they make sense. I think there's two caveats here. Is firstly, the Booker transaction is a relatively small bite for Tesco. It's probably about 10 days cash flow. It's not a huge deal. It's a big proportion. And the second thing is, what it really highlights to me is that everyone who's in mass retail has really got to look at distribution, because the world's about distribution. We're all having more and more distribution at home of bigger and bigger items. And so Tesco's seen that and gone for that. Now, whether the institution's blocked or not, it looks like they might be able to block it. But I think on balance, it's probably going to go through. I do think Tesco paid a bit too much. But on balance, again, it's probably in the best interest of Tesco shareholders.
OK, final word, Jake, or is that it?
I think you summed it up. And I think, but one thing, though, is, you know, Sainsbury's was criticised for its purchase of Argos, and then it's said to be good after that. So, I mean, you're much more of an investor expert than I'm trying to be.
OK, well, you sound pretty good to me, but, gentlemen, we have to leave it there. That is all from today's edition of the Share Radio magazine review. A special thanks to my guests. They are Jonathan Compton. Thank you so much for joining me. Jonathan, of course, is a financial commentator. And Jake Sumner, thank you. He is from ResPublica. It has just gone 4:45 here on Share Radio.